Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of the Cult Popture Podcast was brought to you by our Patreon. If you want to tell us which films we should watch or get two extra exclusive podcasts a month, then please consider joining the cult and donating at www.patreon.com/cultpopture. Ho, 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 ho! Santa's famous catchphrase, repurposed in this case as something that I've said. What do you guys think? Rate it.
Probably prefer when Santa says it.
Is ho 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 public domain?
Almost certainly, I would say. I genuinely don't care.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry. But that is the mood I'm in, given the topic of today.
Well, welcome along, everybody, to the Cult Popture Podcast. My name is AJ, and over here we've got Richard.
Yeah.
And over there we've got Jeremy.
Hello.
And for a rare change of setup for the three of us, it's actually Richard and I in the same room and Jeremy somewhere else for the first time ever.
Banished to Auckland.
Yeah. And you know what? I bet most people who listen to the podcast, you know, 80%
don't
of the time,
give a shit.
They don't give a shit. They don't even remember that we're not in the same room.
Yeah.
But this feels
because we stop pointing it out every week.
Yeah, yeah.
To them, it's basically ho, ho, ho.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all ho, 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 baby.
Well, the reason I said ho, ho, ho is because we're the three hoes of the podcast. And today, because it's Christmassy, and because I guess people enjoyed when we did this last year, we were like, oh, let's watch all the, you know, Netflix drops a bunch of Christmas movies every November, December, that are like Netflix originals. Mm. And last year we covered the four that dropped, and this year there were six that dropped.
Plus a TV show, which none of us watched.
No, I don't want to watch the TV show. So we watched all six, and we're going to discuss them today.
Yeah. All right.
But yeah,
When we said that we were going to do this, we did not know that there were going to be six. Like, there were four last year, and that was fine.
Five is pushing it, six is too many.
Yeah, and next year, I'm sure there's going to be even more.
We can't keep doing this.
Yeah,
well, like, this is unsustainable.
They add two every year.
Yeah,
yeah. So, the six movies are, we've got Holiday Rush, The Night Before Christmas, that's Night with a K, Let It Snow, Klaus, Holiday in the Wild, and...
A Christmas Prince, The Royal Baby.
Yeah.
The third Christmas Prince film. And an MVP for Cult Popture in terms of film franchises, as it's the only one that we don't restrict to our film franchise formats.
Yeah. And we also have never... AJ and I have never seen the first one.
Yep, correct.
I thought, because I feel like we more or less agree on the quality of the film, or like on our rankings, I feel like they wouldn't be too far off, right?
There isn't an arguable ranking of these films. Except Jeremy, king of arguments, is sure to argue us down.
Well, I think you're right, Richard, in terms of, I mean, last year we definitely had some very widely varying enjoyment levels of each of the movies, and this year I think that we have done a bit of off-pod chatter as we've hoed our way through these movies.
Ho, ho, ho,
quite. And I think, I do think that we are, like, a lot closer, just because I think the quality, it's really not up for debate.
That's the thing, and so I would like to go, I think let's go from worst to best.
All right. Ooh. So can I do the honors of saying what I'm assuming we're all thinking?
Yeah.
Okay, so from worst
to best. This is interesting, because I don't even have in my mind yet a solidified definite worst this year.
It's interesting because I think there's two or three that are definitely the worst, and then one or two that are definitely the best, and then the others kind of fall in the middle.
Well, no, there's one and one or two that are maybe one or two.
Yeah.
That are okay to watch.
Yeah.
Okay, so the inarguable definitive ranking of Netflix 2019 from worst to best. We start with Holiday Rush at number 6.
So then let's talk about Holiday Rush.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, you 100%. Don't want to keep going through them.
No, no, no. And then we'll reveal them as we go.
All right. Okay. 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 All right. Holiday Rush. Jeremy, what's Holiday Rush about?
Okay, so Holiday Rush is about a DJ, a radio DJ named Rush. What was his name? His full name?
Holiday.
No. His auntie says his full name. It's like Rushiana or something like that.
Rashawn Rush Williams.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. But his nickname is Rush, and so he's an insanely popular DJ on an R&B station that has sort of gone more mainstream. And at the very beginning of the movie, his children are assholes. They're all insanely wealthy. He's a solo father, and the radio station announces that they're selling up to big corporates. They're taking it nationwide, and he and his producer, who have been together for a long time, working together, are no longer required because they are too R&B and they are not mainstream enough. And so essentially they go, oh crap, you know, this is our money, it's just before Christmas, and they light upon the idea of buying the station that they rose up on, that they became famous on, which has just gone out of business, and trying to launch it within, I think, 8 days. I think they're 8 days away from Christmas, and they want to launch it on Christmas Day, this new radio station.
The biggest radio day of the year.
Christmas Day.
Yeah, absolutely. The day that everyone's doing nothing but listening to radio.
Everyone's on their commute.
And also, it's quite interesting for New Zealand watchers of this movie that actually in New Zealand, it's illegal to advertise on radio and TV on Christmas Day. Mm. And one of the major plot points of this film is that they have to sell advertising to make Christmas Day feasible, and to make the whole radio station feasible, and then they can't sell any advertising because no advertisers will go with them. Yeah, anyway, so they set up this radio station. He has to sell his house. His son is maybe not going to Harvard anymore. His twin girls aren't getting ponies. Like, basically the life of consumerism that his children have become completely in love with over their affections of their father. They no longer have any of these consumer goods. They hate it. They have to move into their old house, which is currently being lived in by their auntie Jo, who's the sort of mystic figure who's, you know, bringing them back to their roots. And Rush himself discovers a love with his producer, which is incredibly telegraphed from the very beginning. The children learn that life is about more than consumer things, and everyone from the radio station basically figures out that they're the bad guys. The old radio station.
My favourite love stories are when the romance comes out of nowhere. I hate it when it's telegraphed. It's very cheesy. It's very... we used this expression last year, and I don't know what other expression to use. It's very Hallmark. It's very... Yeah. It feels like you're watching a Christmas card. And I watched this movie, I think, in 4 parts because I couldn't get through it. And I had to keep coming back to it. And it was just horrific, man. Yeah. Oh, I hated it.
Yeah. Well, so, because one thing you touched on there that made the movie a particularly difficult watch, I think, is that, like, the characters, especially the kids, are just such, like, assholes.
Unrealistic.
Yeah. And, like, because there's a bit where the oldest son goes missing. And then they're like, real worried about him. I was like, why are you even looking for him? Who cares?
Like, he's literally out of high school. He's finished high school.
Let
he's
him fucking go.
Pretty much an adult
Christmas
now.
Will be better without him.
I have a theory about this film.
Yeah.
I think this film was made to perpetuate the lie that radio DJs have that personality at all times, and it's not just they're performing for the show.
You think it was made by a radio broadcaster that was like trying to hide
trying to hide the fact that, you know, everyone has an on and an off, and this movie was made to be like, see, look, even when he's not you know, on air, even when he's not performing, he still sure as hell talks like a radio host, and everyone else in the movie talks like a radio host, because they're all like, wow, what do you think about that? I think that's great. All right. And it's very, like, performative, and how you don't talk to people, you know, your broken family, distraught by the death of the matriarch of the family. You don't talk to your kids the way that he talks to them, as if they're like first time callers. And he's like, well, what do you think about moving back in to our old house and maybe not getting 2 ponies? Which is like, come up with a better thing that the little girls want than two ponies.
Ugh. One pony.
I know, and that's the thing, is like you're basically asking the audience to believe that these children are so far gone that they can't possibly like have any kind of sympathy for their dad, no empathy whatsoever for their dad losing his job. And their first thought when he loses their job is like, oh, how is this going to affect me? Mm. And like it, particularly the oldest son, he's like, oh, I just got accepted to Harvard and you've ruined it all. And it's like, you know that he didn't choose this, right? Yeah. Like he did like narrate this properly to you that he lost his job by no like fault of his own.
Yeah.
And like the son, the whole movie, basically it's like the director told him that his motivation was that he found out that his dad wanted to lose his job to prevent him from going to Harvard.
Yeah. No, and I think, look, there is some meat on the bones of those character motivations, that they resent him for losing his job, even though it's not his fault. But it's not fleshed out in a way where it's like, obviously it's because they in real life, if you were mad at your dad for losing his job around Christmas time and having to, you know, go from your life,
yeah, you'd
luxury,
be feeling hatred towards yourself for feeling that
kind of thing,
struggle of like, and realizing how selfish you feel, but then also like coming to accept the fact that it's like kind of okay to feel like that.
All great ideas, none of which are in the movie.
We've talked broadly about the movie. There are a few moments that I think deserve attention in terms of how bad they are.
Yeah.
All right.
Like, so the main character, Rush, all the way through the film, has these weird like internal monologue versions of "Twas the Night Before Christmas" that like are his own little poems to himself, where he's like making jokes, and like it's in an, like he's thinking these things. It's an internal monologue that we can hear as the audience, and it's like, and then he always finishes them by praying to Saint Nick. Like, where, who prays
Santa's
to Saint
not real,
Nick?
Dude.
Like. And the other thing is like just how bad the children, like it just shows how awful the children are, that when they go to this terrible, terrible house that they, you know, like it's this beautiful house that could absolutely be used as the dream house in any other Christmas movie.
We did all struggle with watching. I think we all took it more than one try to watch this. But there is obviously a like, cultural divide. Mm-hmm. And I think because Jeremy, you kind of like read a lot of subtext into this film about how it's the kids are like sort of losing their roots and their racial identity, which I didn't necessarily pick up on.
Well, I think because it's interesting that I had to look so hard to find this movie on Netflix. Like, I even searched Christmas movies, holiday movie, and like it was just like, no, Jeremy, you're white. You don't want to watch this movie. Like, so I literally had to write Holiday Rush in the search thing to find this movie.
Yeah.
And so it's really interesting to me that obviously this is a sort of a segmented movie for a different audience than me. And so I just think it was just interesting thinking about it and thinking, you know, there's a different type of comedy. There are different cultural sort of tropes around characters and that sort of stuff that definitely like aren't part of the normal, the normal entertainment that I consume. And so just thinking about how awful those children are at the beginning of the movie, like talking with some friends of mine who are not white, like the idea that basically children who grow up in white cultures, predominantly white cultures, who aren't, and when if their parents are very successful and have lots of money and stuff like that, the idea that like children of color can become very comfortable in kind of white society, and this movie, I think in the beginning they are super comfortable and they have lots of wealth, and then the process of the movie brings them back to their old neighborhood. Their dad gets back on the R&B radio station that serves the community that they all come from. The children start to get to know the older people in this black community. It's just very much like when I start to think about it from that perspective, it's a movie that deals in sort of tropes and stories and narratives that are probably quite prevalent in communities where people of color are living. And therefore, I just don't get it. And so, this is why I'm going, this is so cheesy. Whereas, you know, you get a person of color watching Christmas Prince Royal Baby and they're like, I cannot watch this in the same 100%. Way that...
Yeah. And whereas I think we all loved A Christmas Prince 3, the Royal Baby.
As white people.
Yeah. I had no problems with it at all.
It felt like a Madea film in a lot of ways. Like the way it sort of tries to balance comedy and drama and things like that. But having said all this, because what you are describing there, like if you just listen to that isolated from watching the film, I think you're describing quite an intelligent, well-made film.
I was
going to
say that as well.
But... like, aside from, you know, you can say that we didn't pick up on this kind of stuff or we don't read into it like that, it's just not a very well-made film as well. Like,
for sure.
From a technical standpoint, from like it drags
acting-wise alone. The oldest daughter is just horrible to watch.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of things like that that are harder to kind of articulate on a podcast, but like if you just watch the film, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, like the script is bad, the pacing is bad, and all this kind of stuff, and it is just like, because I watched like 15 minutes of it with Jess, and then she was like, can we not watch this? And so I was like, yeah, and then I just watched it before work one day.
Yeah, man, the best content on this podcast always comes from the stuff where beforehand I'm like, I don't know if we should bring this up, guys.
Yeah.
Because I was like, obviously it's a thing, okay? It's a movie that with a predominantly African-American cast. And I was like, oh, God, how do we navigate this conversation about saying this is a bad movie, but also acknowledging that it's made for a completely different demographic. And those demographics do exist. And I'm not, you know...
No, totally. But it's funny to me how, like, I could watch the, like, not to spoil anything, guys, but Christmas Prince Royal Baby is definitely one of the worst. Mm-hmm. But I could watch that without turning it off and having to come back to it because it's kind of like a car crash badness that I'm like, oh my gosh. Whereas with this, I just didn't resonate with, I wasn't fascinated by it. And I just was like interrogating, like, why is that? And I was just like, oh, right. It's because it's not the kind of like cheesiness that really is part of my cultural story.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing as well that like, again, not to spoil what we think of the remaining films, but Holiday Rush, because I think Netflix last year, especially with like the Princess Switch and like the holiday calendar, and even to a lesser extent, like Christmas Chronicles, that they kind of realized, oh, people are watching these because they're quite silly. And so a lot of the on the lower end of films this year have moments or skirt, like, you know, flirt with the idea of leaning into that absurdity and being like, we're in on the joke, but Holiday Rush never does that.
Yeah.
And I think it's the only one that's like you would call like a silly film or like a Hallmark film, a cheesy film that never does that.
Yeah. And if A Christmas Prince, The Royal Baby is a car crash, Jeremy, Holiday Rush is going to your exclusive Brethren Friends church for it because he invited you and you don't really get it and you're pretty bored. It's like, those are the differences. But what I thought was interesting, and maybe, I don't know if you guys have much more to say about Holiday Rush, but what I thought was interesting is that last year, with the exception of Christmas Chronicles, I would say the other three were all from the same category, the same shelf at a DVD store, you know?
The
Christmas themed shelf. This year, I felt like all these movies served a different demographic. And I'd like to maybe dissect that or at least mention that as we go through. So this one is predominantly aimed at like an African-American audience, right? Mm. Like say 18 to 35, maybe a bit older than 18. And so moving on to the second worst film of the year, A Christmas Prince, The Royal Baby. Yes?
Yeah.
I think it is.
Oh, man. It's like, because I know it's intentionally bad, I want to make it not as bad as The Night Before Christmas.
I don't think it's intentionally bad. I think you're giving a lot of credit to the filmmakers there.
Do you remember when Sherlock season 4 bombed and people were speculating that there was a hidden fourth episode?
Because why would they make it so intentionally bad?
That's so tragic. No, and so I think this is the second worst one, and its demographic is females who are our age. Like, it's for women in their early to mid-20s, I think.
Yeah. So basically it's for me.
Yeah, you're part of that demographic, an honorary member.
Yeah, so this one follows on our new king and queen of Aldovia.
We're much like how the Fast and Furious franchise had to really shoehorn cars into the narrative.
Yeah.
This is now, we're like, it's not really about Christmas anymore, but it's called a Christmas Prince, yeah. So we got to do something.
So they have a... There's a baby on the way, and there's this treaty that needs to be signed between Aldovia. Well, they want to add the women to it, right?
There's a treaty between Aldovia and another nation that...
Is it Pinglia?
Yep. That they signed like 600 years ago, and every so-and-so many years, they reunite to sign it again. To, you know, maintain peace, because if the treaty is broken, then they technically are at war again.
Yeah.
Yeah? Is that an accurate summation of the film? Because Rose McIver, is that her name?
Yeah. Well, that's the actor's name.
That's the Christmas Prince.
Yeah. No. Queen Amber of Aldovia.
Queen Amber, because she, and along with the titular Christmas Prince, who's
now Christmas King.
Christmas King. Because a lot of the movie is about being progressive, which is why I say it's aimed at the generation it's aimed at. One of the big reasons, anyway. Not that I am a progressive person, but I acknowledge that this movie is somewhat pandering.
It's too progressive.
It's not too progressive. It's just making a point of being progressive.
Yeah. Look, I'm a progressive guy, but I mean, the treaty's 600 years old. There shouldn't really be women on it.
Yeah. So that's their main pull, is they want it. They want the queens to now sign the treaty as like a show of good faith. But on the day of the signing, the treaty is mysteriously vanished, and
that means that there's a curse on the baby.
Okay, so the little girl, who I think is the king's little sister,
who suddenly can walk with crutches.
What did you, Jeremy? What is
no, I'm sorry, but she's like, it's been a plot point that she's literally in a wheelchair, and it's like, and she was just like, no, there's no hope for me to ever get out of a wheelchair in the first one, and then all of a sudden it's just like, it's really inconvenient if we have to wheel her everywhere, so can we get her in crutches? That would be great.
Is it erasure as well of like
disability,
differently ableist people?
Yeah.
Anyway, so she finds out that there is a curse if the treaty doesn't get
legend
signed.
Tells
yeah that will specifically curse the firstborn of the king, current king and queen. And then, my friends, watch as this movie tries to figure out how to add more stakes, and they're like, "Whoa, there's a curse," and no one in the movie really believes that it's gonna do it, but it's in there because the stakes aren't high enough.
Yeah,
but everyone keeps mentioning it for no particular reason.
It is a fucking writer's or producer's note. They were like, "The stakes aren't high enough." That's what that is.
Yeah, and like,
and look. Go full bore. Make it an actual curse.
Yeah, like you can see the like smoke entering her womb. Yeah.
Like, it is such a, like, I don't even know what else to say.
I mean, I think you're completely right. Make it an actual curse. I mean, we are living in a world where we've got two countries bumped up right next to each other, where one country is completely Anglo-Saxon, white as you can possibly get, and the other one is basically China.
Yeah.
And they barely talk to one another.
They are basically, like,
why
China.
Not? This world is
another
crazy.
Another show of the film being too progressive. It, like, changes geography. Sorry, continue, Jeremy.
Oh, no, I mean, I'm just like, you know, what? Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, they say, oh, there's a curse. And then the next thing that anyone says is the queen is just like, oh, no, sorcery died out years ago. We stopped believing in all that sort of thing. And, like, everyone is just like, oh, but there's a curse. And then in the previous scene, they're like, oh, no, don't be silly. There's no curse. And then the next scene comes along. And it's really interesting because it's like every time a character hears about the curse, they're like, oh, don't worry. We don't believe in curses. But then, like, a new character will come into the scene the next scene,
like,
and the person who's just
they're
heard
real.
About the curse has to tell them about the curse, and they're like, oh, by the way, there's a curse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like there's a rule that if you're hearing about it, you don't believe it. But if you're saying it, you do.
Mm.
Yeah.
But so this movie start when the curse stuff starts happening, it this is one of the ones that flirts with the idea of being like, turning into the skid of how cheesy and ridiculous the idea of a curse is. Mm. And the because you and I were watching it at the same time. I think you were like 10 minutes ahead of me, AJ. Right, okay. And so you were like, oh, fuck, this movie's actually getting like pretty fun.
Yeah, no, exactly. I was like, okay, it's starting to get into so bad it's good territory, because if you're third part of a trilogy where magic hasn't, you know, realistically been part of it so far, suddenly introduces a curse, I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, okay. Yeah.
And then you're like, oh no, it's boring.
Yeah, 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 because they don't dive headfirst into it.
Yeah. So one thing that I just want to touch on again, even though it wasn't one of the best moments of the podcast last year, but because I hadn't seen the first film, and I was shocked to see what the actual Christmas Prince looked like that everyone had been going on about. And Jeremy, you had quite an issue with Rose McIver's hair. Was it fixed for this film?
So did you say it hasn't been fixed in this film?
Yeah.
Absolutely not. Like, she, like, the very first scene, it's this close-up. Again, she's maintaining her blog, Amber's blog, while she's Queen of Aldovia.
Yeah, that's hilarious. Meghan Markle, like, dropped out of being in suits, like, because she became a royal. So I doubt,
and actually quite famously had to stop doing her Instagram and her actual blog because she started dating Harry.
So it's actually a regiment from royals then, right?
Like, yeah, that's right.
It's a branding thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, at least if you're part of the British royalty. But yeah, Aldovia seems to have much.
Progressive.
But the idea, like, just, the screwed up ideas around what royalty can and cannot do in this movie is insane. Like, they're like, she's like, dear readers, we this year have done this in the government. It's like, oh, that's right. In this country, the royal family are actually the government. There is no, like, you know, like, there's no president. There's no, like, prime minister that runs things. The royal family actually make policy decisions and, like, are responsible for, like, fixing poverty and the health system. Mm. Like, and they also somehow have a huge castle with no staff. There are no staff in the whole, like, when, so basically you can tell how cheap this movie is, because they know that they can only have like two big scenes where they have extras, and then for the rest of the movie just has to be a cast of 16 people. And so to get around the fact that they can't have a bunch of people coming in and out for these big events that are happening, like the baby shower and the signing of the treaty and stuff like that, they have this snowstorm which cuts off the castle and means that the castle, you know, only the people who were in the castle at the time of the snowstorm can be in the events of the movie. The thing is, there's like eight people in the whole movie. Yeah. And like, I'm sorry, that castle has a staff of hundreds.
Yeah, I think you're probably forgetting how expensive Rose McIver of iZombie fame, her salary is.
That's true. And also the hairdressing budget on this movie must have been outrageous.
Yeah.
And yet it still sucks.
Apparently.
Well, you know, is it Simon?
The bad guy.
Count Simon.
Yeah. He was the bad guy in the first film, yes?
And then he dramatically returns in the second.
Yeah, and becomes a good guy. What did he do in the first one, Jeremy?
So he was basically, he essentially tried to overthrow the guy who has become the king, whatever his name is.
So pretty, Richard. Pretty bad, right?
Basically treason. Essentially, he what happens is that they've discovered that Richard, yes. Oh man, this is going back a long while, but basically Richard is not, was Richard, the king, the old king who died in the first movie, he wasn't married to Richard's mother before he had Richard or something like that. And basically Simon discovers this and basically tries to declare Richard illegitimate so that he, as his cousin, could become the king instead.
Okay, so that's all fine. But what in another way that this series inexplicably copies the same problems as, like, Fast and Furious. Like, the villains from the last film are now part of the good guy crew. And, like, in this one, he's dating Amber's friend from New York, and it's very, like, what? like the sky no literally tried to commit treason. And she's like, oh, I don't know if he's the one for me. And Amber's like, oh, sweetie, like, you're
oh my God, he's such a good guy.
You'll find out. And it's like, this is the bad guy. This guy. He tried to literally
killed Han.
And also another thing that I wanted to bring up is that at the end of the movie, when she has the royal baby, which is very little to do with the actual plot, her dad from New York turns up and says some hammy line and everyone goes, it's the dad.
Hey, I'm walking here.
Yeah, and everyone's like, it's the dad. He's goes like, nah, you go. And then he goes and sees his daughter and he holds his granddaughter, as we find out. And she says to him, her name is Ellery. And he's like, you named her after mom. And I was like, thank you, dad, in this movie, because I didn't know that. And like, it's one of those, it's a classic example of like, he wouldn't say that in real life. Like, your daughter hands you your baby and names her after your dead wife. And you're like, you know, I named her dead wife's name. And he's like,
oh, yeah.
I don't need to say why. I know why. Especially with a name
He would actually just cry.
Yeah.
You'd be like, oh, sick.
Yeah. But to be honest, if he didn't say that, I'd be like, why is that significant?
Yeah.
I would just love it if he would just like, that's a bit morbid.
That's a bit. I'm actually not going to.
I'm probably not going to, because it'll bring up too many memories. Yeah, I'm not going to come visit.
Yeah.
Does she have a middle name I can use?
AJ. all right, what's next on our list?
Okay, so we've got Holiday Rush, The Christmas Prince, The Royal Baby. Is it The Christmas Prince
Christmas
3?
Prince. Our Christmas Prince, The Royal Baby.
So no
Royal
3. Baby. Okay, next in line to the throne of not as the better Christmas movies. This is going to be the most contentious, but I'm confident in my placing. It's The Night Before Christmas.
I disagree.
Yeah, you do disagree.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Sorry, what's the fourth one? I've
Holiday
totally
in the
forgotten.
Wild.
Oh, no. Sorry. Holiday in the Wild is definitely worse than
Night Before Christmas. Let's do Holiday in the Wild.
Okay. So this is actually one that we knew was coming. If you listen to our most anticipated of 2019, I said, oh, there's a new Christmas movie, Netflix. It was then called Christmas in the Wild, but then they kind of wrote Christmas out of it, but still released it in December. But that stars Rob Lowe and Kristen Davis from Sex and the City fame. And wow, what's this one about?
So, and what is could just be a Charlotte-centered spin-off of Sex and the City.
Which I was kind of hoping that there'd be more of that sort of feel.
Well, I mean, that's why she's in the movie, is because it's this one's demographic is mums, I think, right?
Yeah.
It's got, you know, your mum's hot heartthrob Rob Lowe
and
the gal from her favourite TV show in it. And so
they go to the place she's always been meaning to go.
she is part of like a broken marriage. She's very rich, very very privileged, part of a broken marriage. And after their son leaves for college, her husband divorces her. And so she does what I actually pitched in the Sex and the City episode of Film Franchise Fortnights should have been the plot of Sex and the City, the movie. She goes on their second honeymoon without him. Like by herself,
which is
what I said that the Sex and the City, the movie, should have been about. And so she goes to Africa where she meets Rob Lowe, who's like a safari guide. They find an elephant that's just, its mother's been poached. Is that the right way to say that?
Sure.
just been killed by poachers.
With some hollandaise sauce.
Yeah.
And so he's like, he takes it. She's like, I'm a vet, which I'm revealing for the first time in the movie.
Yeah.
And they go back to the elephant sanctuary, and she falls in love with the elephants, and she falls in love with Rob Lowe, and spends more time than she intended to.
And then it's
Africa.
Kind of a Sophie's choice which one she's going to go with, Rob Lowe or the elephants.
But like, what's funny is the movie actually starts in August and is like, okay, so obviously she's going to be here for a long time if it's a Christmas movie.
But it starts with them taking their Christmas card photo in August.
Yeah.
And then that's kind of one of the main references to Christmas in the film.
Yeah. And you know, she becomes involved in the community, eventually has to go back to New York to visit her friends who they call the ladies who lunch, which may as well just be the title of Sex and the City.
Yeah.
And then the last 15 minutes of the movie is a lot of stuff happens. She goes back, she gets a new job, she discovers that the job isn't fulfilling and moves back to Africa, all in like 15-minute space, where one of those things should be happening in that space. It's real funny because her decision to move back is because she just becomes a regular vet and is talking to someone who's brought their dog in for like the third time that week. And she's like, what's the matter with her? And she's like, oh, she just needs more antidepressants. And so the implication being that, no, your dog's not depressed. Can dogs be depressed? Is that
I think so,
The implication is that that's an unrealistic thing for your dog to have, that she's sick and tired of these privileged idiots with pets to look after, and she'd rather look after elephants. Yeah?
And Rob Lowe. Yeah. There's a good summation.
Yeah.
I just think that she realizes how depressed she is without Rob Lowe around.
Yeah, she's like, antidepressants. I need antidepressants.
And by antidepressants, I mean Rob Lowe. Yeah. Okay, so I know why I rank this higher than The Night Before Christmas. And it's because, I haven't mentioned this yet, I've just come back from Africa. An hour ago, I was in the Africa of New Zealand, Blenheim, my birthplace of Blenheim. Blenheim is the most boring place in New Zealand, legit. It sucks. I hate it. I was seeing family down there, and they weren't boring. They were fine. Yeah. They were fine, 5 out of 10.
They're the holiday in the wild of people.
Yeah. And I was staying at my grandfather's house, who has no internet, and so I had to download this and Let It Snow beforehand. And so I watched this movie last night in a world of no internet and nothing to do. And maybe it was just like, but you know what? I was like, this is enjoyable because it's a movie.
This is better than nothing.
But half an hour before it finished.
This is better than talking to my family.
Half an hour before it finished, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation came on TV. And I found it very hard to pay attention to the movie.
Is that why you kind of skipped through the final like plot summary of this?
I was trying harder to pay attention and summer, or maybe it's why I remember it being a bit holiday rushed. So maybe that's the reason. And like, I like Rob Lowe. He's a good Christmas present.
what this movie has going for it is Rob Lowe and Kristen Davis. They are both very watchable screen presences. And everything else is what's wrong with the movie. Like, it just... Oh, man. The thing that really gets me about this movie... the thing that really gets me about this movie is that, like, every problem that pops up is almost immediately dealt with. So, like, right near the end of the movie, you've got this weird blonde South African girl who's, like, weirdly... is in a relationship with Rob Lowe, but also at the same time, absolutely not in a relationship with Rob Lowe.
I think the implication is that she is the daughter of the head of the funding board for this elephant orphanage, and so getting funding was like, hey, if you bang me, I'll get you funded.
But it's weird because like early in the movie, Kristen Davis like leaves Rob Lowe's tent after discovering him topless. And then as she's leaving, we see this random blonde woman like walking up to the tent and looking at her like, ooh, you're my competition. Mm. But at no stage do we ever see her and Rob Lowe having any kind of romantic connection whatsoever. Sorry. And then at the end of the movie, like towards the end of the movie, when Kristen Davis is back in New York and he's drawing a picture of her, the blonde woman comes in and basically says, whatever this is, it's over. And I'm like, no one knew what this was.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden, the elephant sanctuary has no funding whatsoever. And so Kristen Davis hears about this, and there's whole movies like Sing, and like, which is all about like, hey, we've lost our funding for this really important thing that we all love. Now the community has to come together and like raise the funds for this and all this stuff. And all of it is dealt with in a 2-minute montage of Kristen Davis just walking around her ridiculously wealthy New York friends, including her ex-husband, who basically just like at the beginning of the movie drops her like a stone without any care in the world. And somehow she's able to squeeze $160,000 out of him over course of a lunch, and he like smiles at her. Mm. It's just like, so weird how this massive issue is just dealt with as not a problem at all.
I didn't want a movie about elephants and exotic locales. I wanted a movie about raising money.
it was so ridiculous that like, It was a problem for 2 seconds. You know, like, oh man, we got to raise money for the elephant sanctuary. Nope, you don't. And also, everyone still uses checks in this movie, and you can send a whole envelope full of checks across the world through, like, mail, and it's all good.
One thing I noticed about this movie, and Jeremy, you've watched it twice, is that correct?
Yeah.
So I would like your expertise on
this. I barely
watched
it once.
Yeah, I'd like your expertise on this. There are two parts in this movie, two sort of throwaway lines of dialogue, where I feel like there are deleted scenes in this movie. I feel like I haven't phrased this properly. I feel like there are deleted scenes in this movie. And
you just phrased it the same way.
When you edit out a deleted scene, you kind of have to edit out any mention of that deleted scene.
Right.
But there are two instances which I feel they mentioned something that didn't happen.
So when I watched this movie again, I found like a 5-minute scene that I had no recollection of at all. So like, I've seen this scene that you're talking about.
Okay. So the first thing, I think, I can't remember which order they happen in, but I'm going to say the first one is after she reconnects with Rob Lowe at the elephant orphanage after, because they find the elephant and she goes with the safari and he flies back.
Yeah.
He sort of mentions all the stuff that about her, like he's like, oh, you know, you got to get back to the ladies who lunch, and she's like, oh, I told you all about that, and he's like, oh yeah, and it's like, when did she? Like it's almost like she got real drunk and spilled the beans, and doesn't remember telling him.
Because she's kind of like, oh, I can't believe
it.
This is where, like, I literally watching this a second, because I have to explain why I watched this a second time. I watched this when it first came out on Netflix, like in early November. And so, like 2 days ago, I have no recollection. My brain has willfully scrubbed this from my memory. And so, yes, when she first meets Rob Lowe and, like, he basically says, oh, you're alone, huh? She, like, basically vomits out, like, her life story. And she's just like, and somehow I became one of the ladies who lunch. I'm a vet, for God's sake.
Okay. All right. Well,
yeah.
You know, there you go.
Rob Lowe has got a better memory than you.
And the other part is,
it's not just elephants who don't forget. Oh. It's Rob Lowe, too.
I'm the opposite of an elephant. The other part is when she first sees the blonde South African girl later, like when she's introduced to her, she walks away and Rob Lowe chases after her because he's like, oh, don't go, it's not what it looks like or whatever. And she says to him, I've never met someone with 5 last names or something like that before. Mm. And it feels, and I don't know what that woman's name is, and I don't think at any point does she say, like, my name is name, because it's South African and she has 5 last names, apparently.
Yeah,
but I definitely tuned out of the movie at that point, and like both times I watched it. So no.
So the one scene that is not deleted, just not handled very well for me to remember it. I'm blaming the movie, not me. And one scene that is a mystery. It's a Christmas mystery. What is the blonde South African woman's 5 surnames? If that's even the line.
Maybe we'll find out in the sequel.
Is there going to be one?
No.
I hope not.
No.
I don't know.
The other crazy thing about this movie is how, like, the casting of Kristen Davis's son is unreal to me. Like, he is
He's a small Chinese boy.
whatever the opposite of charisma is, he is like the living embodiment of that. Like, I just don't understand how, out of all the guys who would have auditioned for this role, he was the best person for them to cast. Like, I'm like, man, Netflix really needs to up their game in terms of their casting agents, because,
well, I guess, man, they just needed to make Kristen Davis look good.
I disagree. No. Not with Kristen Davis looking good. She's beautiful. I thought the son was actually a notably cool kid. I liked him. I thought he had charisma. And I'll die on this hill in this talking point I never anticipated talking about.
The other crazy thing is that, like, they try to make the son interesting and give him a whole life. Like, he's at college, he's doing music, he wants to drop out of college to do music. Mm. And again, this is another one of those problems that sort of rears its head, that's somehow this massive problem for a character, and then it's just all kind of done away with in one decision, which is she decides to convince him to study music at college, which is so great because that means he's still at college. And I'm like, no, that's the worst of all worlds, because now he's still doing music and won't make any money for the rest of his life, and he's going to have like a $120,000 college bill.
Very frugal of you, Jeremy. Yeah. But again, that's a mum movie.
Problem
and solution, isn't it? Like, if this was Christmas Prince and he was like, I don't want to study this at college, they'd be like, of course, sweetie. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
You know, this is a movie where
and he actually would be a small Chinese boy.
It is such an absurd problem to us for, you know, like, and to be honest, if I told my parents that I was dropping out of college, they probably wouldn't. Like, they'd care in a good way. Like, they'd be like, we just, you know, want to make sure that you're doing what's best for you. They would, like, there's such an importance on going to college in America, and specifically,
It's okay, AJ, as long as you keep doing your podcast, you can do whatever you want.
Sweet.
That's the thing that's going to bring you success.
Well,
one of these days.
So, The Night Before Christmas, then, is the next worst one.
Yep.
That's aimed at teenage girls. That's Vanessa Hudgens. That's It's not.
I think it's actually it's preteen.
Yeah,
I think it's preteen girls.
Yeah.
It's not smart or clever enough, or at least it's not attempting to be what A Christmas Prince is attempting to be, for me to say it's also for 25 year old women.
It's not winking. Anyone.
So this one's about essentially a spiritual sequel to A Princess Switch.
Yeah.
Right. It's almost identical in tone, stars Vanessa Hudgens, and
it's set at Christmas time.
What's this one about?
This one is about a knight from the 1300s gets teleported to time traveled to 2019 Connecticut or wherever this takes place, and where he falls in love with Vanessa Hudgens' character. This was the first one I watched. No, the second one I watched actually quite a while ago, so I don't really remember it.
I actually, like, for me, this is now we've entered the I would watch it again.
Pathetic.
You scum. You piece of shit.
It's cool being in the same room as you because I can see when the actual spit flying.
Do you miss
me.
It from when we used to record in the same room all the time?
So this is one of those, like, you have to fall in love to break the curse. But it's a fish out of water story about this knight from the 1300s adjusting to real life. So he discovers Netflix and watches Holiday in the Wild.
he does. We're not kidding.
Like all normal people. Like, you know, it's him and all of the empty nester mothers who are watching Holiday in the Wild.
Yeah. And from that he learns phrases like it's lit and that's fire. Which one aren't in Holiday in the Wild. And also it's like, oh honey, don't put that in your screenplay, please. This is textbook how to turn off kids.
Yeah. No one is going to learn those features of language in a way that allows them to use them correctly like figures of speech in conversation in a day.
And he also learns like an American accent from that as well.
Mm.
Like,
which he
talks like this and then he goes, I learned phrases like, it's lit.
Yeah. Okay, fundamental issue with this film. The issue with this film. And I'm going to draw from personal experience to illustrate it better.
Okay.
I once made a short film. It was pretty bad. You've both seen it. I think Jeremy's seen it. It was about time travel. It was about a time travel rehab center where all these people who have involuntarily time traveled are now being rehabilitated in a rehab center.
So you're saying that the problem with this film is it doesn't have your ass in it?
This is too deep for people who haven't seen either film you're talking about.
Go and look at AJ's short film. It has his ass in it.
All right. I'll link in the show notes.
But link this to my film, ass.
We didn't realize till after we made it. The fundamental problem with it is that we tell you these are people from other times.
Yeah.
But in waking life, in real life, and when we filmed it, they're just people in costumes.
Yeah.
And so in our film specifically, we don't give you any indication that these actually are time-traveled people and not just crazy people. And while The Night Before Christmas does flat out show you him in the 1300s before taking him to present day. Sent by the old crone. It does not do a good enough job of making him look realistically like a 12th century.
Yeah, because he's just some fucking hot dude.
He is a cartoonish caricature of what you think of when you think of a medieval knight.
He's basically a middle, like, kind of very lax British kind of stereotype. Yeah. Like modern day proper British stereotype. And he's supposed to be from medieval times.
Yeah. And no one, like, none of the... this is such a Jeremy thing to complain about in a movie.
Yes,
which
yes!
Normally, normally I'd take issue with because I'd regard it as like semantics and finicky, and it doesn't matter. But I only say this because I think they missed an opportunity here, where like. He acclimatizes to 2019 very easily.
Well, because it's essentially over one night where he spends all night watching Netflix and playing with Alexa.
Yeah, and those are like the equivalent of in The Fifth Element when Lilu watches like that video takes up to speed. Like, and you're missing an opportunity of things like 13th century English sounded nothing like what we say today. You're missing things like he's handsome and has perfect teeth and isn't dying of gout. Like he doesn't reach 2019 and immediately dies because the bacteria is like is like something that he has not.
So you would have preferred if he'd immediately died.
Not immediately died, but maybe Vanessa Hudgens is a nurse, you know, or a doctor. Fuck you. Maybe she and
no. That's Christmas Prince Royal Baby. That's the woke one.
She's a nurse in this one.
Yeah, I'm not a regressive person. I was staying true to the regressive nature of this film. And she's like, this guy has, you know, we can really easily fix it. And maybe that's less realistic, but still more in depth. My point is, he looks like a guy dressing up as a knight for a kid's birthday party, and eventually everyone just buys that he's a real knight. Which I know he is. I know he is, but they believe
no one
him.
In the world of the film has a good reason to accept that.
Yeah. That's, thank you. That's exactly what I'm saying.
But I'm a sucker for like I love the first Thor movie, even though I know like most people don't. And it's the same kind of thing. Like they go to like a Denny's.
It's the scene from Thor.
It is. It's the same thing. When he loves this delicious mead and he goes, "Wench," another one. And everyone just like acts like he's just said the C word.
Yeah.
And like
he said the W word.
Yeah. And then everyone's like, whoa, shit. But there's this quite funny thing about So she's just broken up with her and her boyfriend have just broken up when she meets this guy, and she goes, he's a bit of a douche, as the kids say. And then he's like, oh, okay, like this douche. And then he ends up borrowing some of his clothes, some of the ex-boyfriend's clothes. And then they see him at the Denny's and like, oh, that's my ex-boyfriend. He's like, oh, I shall thank the douche. And that was I actually fucking cracked up with that. But
We get you loved this shitty movie, okay?
I took issue with Vanessa Hudgens saying douche, as the kids say, which is something that the kids haven't said for about 10
about
years.
30 years.
And you feel you in that moment, you feel the 47-year-old in the writer's room, like trying to write lines to put into Vanessa Hudgens' mouth.
But this is the best example of a film being like, oh, people liked The Princess Switch because it was ridiculous, and so we'll add a supernatural element to it, and we'll just make the film fucking stupid. And next year, we're getting The Princess Switched Again, starring Vanessa Hudgens.
Which sounds
Vanessa Hudgens and Vanessa Hudgens.
He's not kidding. We are.
It's three. It's the Prince and the Pauper, like
with an
plot
extra
outline. Now with an extra person. Never been done.
Never
before.
Been done. And as two guys who watch so many franchises, you know, probably 10% of which do a Princess and the Pauper story, we've never done three ways before. I'm so excited.
Wow, just watching you guys kind of melt down in a way that's very unstable is quite... I'm glad I'm not in the same room as you for once.
But I do... you're normally not... Oh, that's cute. I do love the idea of it being an annual tradition to have Vanessa Hudgens in a Christmas film with increasingly ridiculous premises.
Which, we spitballed this, didn't we?
Yeah.
And what I suggested was Vanessa Hudgens switches bodies with baby Jesus in a movie that combines the concept of time travel
and
with Prince
swapping.
Of the Pauper.
Yeah.
And she body swaps with the baby Jesus, and it's called Away in a Stranger.
Yeah.
What do you guys think?
That's fucking, I love that.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
That's the greatest thing I've ever heard. Yeah, but like...
Well, she looks in the mirror and she's like, I'm Jesus! Oh, no!
Yeah. Sorry, Jeremy, are you still there?
Yeah.
You just weren't reacting to any of our hilarity.
I'm just not laughing at anything.
Because the movie ends in kind of a weird place where the knight ends up coming back to the future, right? But then there's also like his knight friend from the 1300s. There's something weird
his
with
brother.
Him, right? Sorry? His brother, yeah.
His brother.
His knight brother.
Yeah, his knight brother. What happens with him? Does he gets knighted or something, right?
Ugh. It's his knighting. It's the day that he's about to become knighted or something like that. But I do think
it
that
does
this
set
is
itself
setting
up for a sequel.
It's setting up for a crossover with A Christmas Prince, I think.
Well, yeah, because her parents are in Aldovia in the film.
Yeah. And also I think that the timing in the 1300s it's interesting that it's just before the treaty signing.
Oh, fuck. We're going too deep. Oh, no other podcast is discussing this.
I fucking would love a Netflix-mas shared universe. Yeah. That'd be fucking incredible.
Yeah. The crazy thing about this Night Before Christmas thing is beyond everything that's insane about Vanessa Hudgens' life in that... One, she lives in this enormous house that has a guest house because both of her parents have just recently died. And her sister, who has a like husband and child, didn't really bother to like split the estate with her. It's just like, just keep living in that enormous house with a guest house. Why not? And also the fact that she eats muffins by picking at them with her fingers and not actually eating the muffin. The crazy thing is that the old crone sends him to the future with the sense that he has to find his destiny in order to get back to the past.
Yeah.
But finding his destiny is finding out that he is going to fall in love with a woman from the future and need to stay there. And so then as soon as he comes back to the past, he's like, no, I want to go back to the future again.
I wish my destiny was to fall in love with Vanessa Hudgens.
Hell yeah.
I wish that was what I was destined to do. It was my fate and I could not escape it no matter how hard
imagine
I tried.
Like if you believe in there being only one person for each person.
Yeah.
And this movie's like, you could live 700 years apart. There's not always going to be an old crone.
No. That's true.
Well, I think this movie proves there will be an old crone. But AJ, I mean, not everyone can be an absolutely forgettably vanilla-looking English-speaking man.
What is the deal
though with the Netflix like casting of men this year? Like all of them are just like Vanessa Hudgens, super hot. Like, why could they not hire someone who was like of an equivalent kind of star power or star factor? Like he has, again, like
they waste all their money on Vanessa Hudgens.
It's sexist, frankly. It's the idea that you don't have to be as, you know, if you want a hot wife, you don't have to put
in
the hard yards.
You just have to be a knight from the 1300s.
Yeah. And you know what? She thinks he's real hot. Ask him what he thinks of homosexuality. Ask him what he thinks of black people.
Yeah.
This guy is going to be super problematic.
Yeah.
Oh, hell yeah.
Oh, I'm not even kidding. Of course he will be.
Yeah. But then, put him in Aldovia, ask what he thinks.
Be careful. All right.
The other thing I have to say about Night Before Christmas is it's actually one of the three movies that I felt was really strange this year, where three of these movies have had countdowns to Christmas or Christmas Eve on the screen.
Yes.
So it's like, this is the number of days. And it was so, and like, and the first one I watched that had it in it was Night Before Christmas. And I was like, oh yeah, you know, obviously
you
we're
know
counting down
to
Christmas Eve because that's when he has to have done his, you know, but then Christmas Prince also has a countdown to Christmas Eve because that's the time when like they have to have signed the contract. And then bloody Holiday Rush also. I mean, Holiday Rush doesn't have the kind of... Well, it does have the stakes because they're going to be launching their radio station on Christmas Day.
The stakes in Holiday Rush are very convoluted and I didn't understand them. But anyway, continue.
Yeah, well, it's just like... It's like you said before, AJ, about the producer's note of like, we need greater stakes. It's like, we need something on the screen at the beginning of every day in the movie to like remind us that there's this countdown of the thing that needs to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just super 100%. Cheap and I hate it. It's so awful.
Yeah, I hate it too, dude.
Also, with Night Before Christmas, like seriously, this Christmas Eve dinner that, like, it's just like they needed something in the movie, like, to get everyone together. And so she's like got this thing where, oh yeah, my mum and dad did this Christmas Eve dinner thing where they invited, you know, people who were in need around to, like, give them Christmas. And somehow over the years that's morphed into a paid sit down dinner for, like, the entire town.
And Vanessa Hudgens, I watched this with my flatmate, and when this scene comes up, she was like, why is Vanessa Hudgens so well dressed up? And everyone else is wearing, like, a cardigan and jeans. And Vanessa Hudgens did, like, this, like, insane dress, and no one else is, like, dressed anywhere near the same.
Well, she knows that she's going to kiss for the first time that night.
Oh. Hell yeah. A kiss.
All right. A kiss. So.
Also, now, there's only one poor family in the entire town, and I just loved that so much.
Yeah, fuck them.
We don't need to talk about them. If they wanted to be talked about, they'd have money. All right. So now there's only two films left.
Yeah.
We'll go what's second place. And then, you know, those who were paying attention at the start might be able to work out what number one is.
So second place is Let It Snow.
Correct.
Yeah.
So this is actually based. I just found out this is based on a book,
a John Green novel.
Yeah, well, it's collaborated. It's called Let It Snow: Three Holiday Romances, and it's three intertwining stories, all written by different authors, one of whom is John Green.
And so this demographic is teenagers. It's about teenagers. It's
by teenagers, fourteen.
So this one, I watched this also in Blenheim at my grandfather's house with no internet. Loved it. I was expecting. I had no idea what this movie was. I loved it. It's not the best well-made movie. Like it is. It's a Netflix movie.
Yeah.
But it's lovely. It's very wholesome. It's very sweet. It's Love Actually in small town USA. There's a bit of swearing in it.
Yeah.
There's a bit of sex jokes in it.
Yep.
It's a good fun movie. It stars bankable stars.
Of that age. It's got
Sabrina the Teenage Witch, or some chilling adventures of Sabrina.
It's got Shameik Moore, who was the voice of Miles in Into the Spider-Verse. And then it also has and then it also has Ned from the
Spider-Man
MCU, who's Jagged Battleon. And then it's also got Isabella Mona. Mm-hmm. Is she in it? No, she's not.
It's got Ray William Johnson's ex-girlfriend in it.
And it's got Joan Cusack. Isabella Mona.
Teen heartthrob Joan Cusack.
Yeah, Isabella Mona, who's the
in Lady Bird?
Huh?
The popular girl from Lady Bird is the one who's obsessed with her phone.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, she's the one that's, she's Dora the Explorer.
Oh.
Isabella Mona. Liz.
Oh, of course!
Yeah.
Have you talked about Karen Chilka?
That's Sabrina, right?
Yeah, the girl. Or she's also she was the little girl from Mad Men.
Oh, she nice.
Oh, nice. Yeah, man. What did you guys think? I thought this was
a really nice film.
Yeah,
it is. This is the kind of film that I would love my kids to watch.
Yeah,
you know, like with the kind of shit like Netflix movies that come out. If I had a teenage kid who wanted to watch one of these, this is like, it's wholesome, and you would be quite happy for your kid to learn values from this film, you know, rather than like The Night Before Christmas.
Yeah. And so I don't think we see what it's about. It follows, as the book title suggests, it follows three separate love stories. They're all kind of connected because they're all friends, or they're all, you know, mutual like, friends.
It's similar to Love Actually, where they kind of.
In this little town in the middle of America, it's on Christmas Eve, and there's a party happening at a waffle house.
Yeah.
What are the love stories? There's a guy who's been pining after his best friend his whole life. There's
a famous guy who's coming through town.
Yeah, there's a Justin Bieber analog who's played by the guy from
Shameik Moore.
And he, you know, their train gets stopped because of the snow, and so he
falls in love with Dora the Explorer.
He falls in love with Dora the Explorer. And the other one is
who hasn't?
The other one is a girl who had a fling with another girl, and they're kind of from other sides of the high school clique spectrum, and so they meet up again at the Waffle House, and there's a bit of like, oh, it doesn't seem like she likes me anymore, but she actually does, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And then Joan Cusack's kind of like the Rowan Atkinson of this film.
Mm.
And it all culminates in a like a party that what's his face, Ned from Spider-Man, is like Jacob, an aspiring DJ, and he wants to like have a party where he DJs, and he can't do it at his house because his parents were supposed to go away, but they ended up not going away. So he ends up having a party that possibly night at the Waffle House, which is kind of the culmination of where all these stories end up meeting at the end of the movie.
Yeah. And there's some great jokes in it. There's one part where they're trying to get their car started, and he's like, come on, get your sweet ass working. It's like, yeah, back that ass up. And then the guy in the back's like, all right, guys, I know it's just a car, but I'm actually a feminist. What a great line. Hilarious.
He should come on this podcast.
Yeah. Join us, other feminists.
Yeah. We'll move to Aldovia.
we moved to Aldovia, which is like, you know, the opposite of what the UK is now. Topical UK
election humor.
And so what else? Oh, my favorite scene in this film is there's two scenes I really loved. One is when they go into this like seemingly abandoned church and they play, I've never heard the song, they're called like You Saw the Hole of the Moon or something, on piano, and they sing along to it. It's very sweet.
Yeah. On the organ. Cute.
On the organ, yeah, true. Mm. And the other one is when the Justin Bieber analog and Dora the Explorer go back, a tale as old as time, go back to her house where her grandfather, you know, knows that this guy's a musician, but, you know, doesn't know what kind of musician he is. Yeah. And he talks about like a, who is this? Is it the Rolling Stones guy?
Of Mick Jagger.
His favorite Mick Jagger song, and the Justin Bieber analog is like, that one's all right, but I prefer this one. And then they put on a Mick Jagger song. Is it a Mick Jagger or just Rolling Stones?
They do talk about Mick Jagger, but I think it's Rolling Stones.
And then they do impressions of him dancing. Yeah. It's very fun.
Which is also very topical because fucking everyone seems to be asking young celebrities if they've heard of this person, and there's this obnoxious fucking bullshit that seems to be happening every week. But yeah, it is like, it's just such a nice movie.
I'll watch this again.
Yeah.
It is charming. It is charming as all hell, and I really, really enjoy it.
This is the kind of movie that AJ tells me he's going to show his sister.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
Yeah. I expected to feel like, I mean, I'm 34 now, guys. I have my own child. What the heck? And so.
Oh, yeah. We haven't mentioned that. Is that canon on the podcast? You had your baby.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you mentioned it a while ago in a podcast.
Well, mentioned you were having
Listening, I was listening at home, and I was like, ooh, here I am on the podcast without being on the podcast.
That's right,
Thanks, guys.
Okay, so don't go on about it because we haven't mentioned it.
We get it, you have a baby.
But yeah, I mean, like, being so far away from this stage of life, the teen stage of life, I expected this movie not to resonate with me as much, and I just freaking loved it. I loved spending time with these characters. I loved being in this little small town. I thought it had real heart. Like the scene, it's so interesting. I totally loved both of the scenes that you mentioned, AJ, and I particularly loved the scene when they go back to Dora the Explorer's house. Whatever's going on my neighborhood. But anyway, they go back to Dora the Explorer's house, and just the tension that's there with both of them not really saying what they really want or what they really think. And you know, as the audience, that beautiful tension of knowing that both of them are actually really good-hearted and totally in it for the right reasons, but they aren't at that point of trust yet. And actually just sitting in that for a while, it's just movie magic. And I just loved it. It was great.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. This is a great, this is the first great Zuma movie that I've seen.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
Like, yeah, this is the first movie that's completely, eighth grade would be probably.
Oh, true.
Yeah. But it's that similar kind of thing.
Eighth grade is about 10 times as good as
But yeah, it like encapsulates that, and it's like it's a tried and true framework of a film, essentially. Like,
well, I would draw a direct line between 10 Things I Hate About You and this. So, like, this is the 10 Things I Hate About You for the Zoomer generation.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah.
Like, it's got heart, it's got humor, it's got like kind of angst, but then it's got a resolution that feels genuine to the teen experience rather than just cheesy.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, what do you guys think of Joan Cusack?
I freaking loved her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sick.
Yeah, it was such a fun character to bring into to bring into the world of, like,
yeah,
you know,
if you're wondering how she fits into the film as well, like, it is very similar to Rowan Atkinson in Love Actually, I think. That right. It's just like, just pops up and is kind of wacky.
She's like a snow, what's that called? Like, she shovels snow with her truck.
Mr. Plow.
She's Mr. Plow, yeah. But she mysteriously wears tinfoil all over her outfit, and no one knows why, and she won't tell anyone why.
Yeah.
And she narrates the film.
She's kind of a weird, weird conspiracy theorist, kind of boomer representative in the movie, even though she's not actually a boomer.
watching the film and frustrating me, because I couldn't quite work out who the narration was, and then she popped up. I was like, oh, of course.
Yeah, man. Well, hey, look, I would be like, this is far and away the best Netflix Christmas movie.
Like, this is so much better than anything last year.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I'd be like, this is great. This is the peak. This is what all Netflix Christmas movies should aspire to be. But the next movie, the best movie of this year's Netflix 2019, is so good. It just feels so fucking stupid to even be mentioning it on this podcast with the rest of these movies. And that is, of course, Klaus, the beautifully animated, like, Christmas legend.
I just got chills.
Like, guys.
Fucking hell. So this was the first one I think all of us watched, right?
And after that it was like, it's going to be a long year, Netflix.
So this is directed by the guy that created Sergio Pablos, who created Despicable Me. And it's like, this is one of those, if you haven't seen it, stop what you're doing, go and watch the film. This film is so fucking good.
Yeah.
We talked about how good Let It Snow is, but that was like, I think when we were talking about Let It Snow, it's like, yeah, we liked it, but we're talking about it being good by Netflix Christmas standards.
And also no internet and Blenheim standards.
Klaus is a fucking gorgeous film. It's like, so it's animated, it's a tale of the creation of Christmas, essentially. So it's about a
Santa's origin story.
Yeah, it is a Santa's origin story. So it's this postmaster, this heir to this like postal fortune, who's the spoiled brat, essentially, gets told you have to go start a post office in the town of Smearensburg.
The
island of Smearensburg, where and you have to, what is it, 1,000 letters in a year?
Something like that.
Some arbitrary number that he has to achieve. 3,000 letters. And to, you know, create a post office to show that you're worthy of it. He's voiced by Jason Schwartzman of Phantom Planet. He's the drummer for Phantom Planet. Do you know that?
Yeah. I don't even know what Phantom Planet is.
We've been in the sun driving, looking at California. Here we go. Yeah. And then he essentially gets the idea to tell kids that if they write a letter, you know, you'll get something in exchange. And so he ends up teaming up with this big, burly woodsman he finds in the forest called Klaus, who's got a big white beard and is voiced by J.K. Simmons. And how fucking good is Netflix at casting Santa?
Yeah, I was gonna say that.
Kurt Russell and J.K. Simmons. but they team up. He's made all these toys, and then they essentially create the legend of Santa Claus.
And you see, it's the same way that, like, the, you know, when a comic book movie gets upgraded to the big screen, they have to find, like, movie realistic ways of mentioning their superhero name.
Yeah,
you know?
So
do they call you down at the precinct? Oh, they called me Two-Face.
Yeah, and he laughs like, ho, 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 and they're like, is that really how you laugh? Yeah, and there's a bit where they travel in, like, a reindeer-drawn sleigh, and there's a bit where they, like, end up going over some kind of ramp and someone sees them out the window flying, and then that's how this myth is created. But it ends up,
and elves are small Russian Orthodox.
Yeah. So like, well, it's Sami. It's an actual
Sami people.
Yeah, Sami. That's the word. And
they team up and become his elves.
Yeah, it's actually like an actual language that's essentially dying or almost dead. And there's the main elf, who's voiced by a little girl who didn't speak any English, and then the process of directing her was similar to the relationship she has with the main character, right, of like this kind of trying to find a mutual language.
Clearly your favorite one, because it's the only one you've done behind the scenes research.
So and I found that this actually The first trailer for this came out in 2015, January 2015.
What the hell?
And it was a completely different character voices and everything like that. It was essentially shown as a proof of concept because you kind of need to go look at the trailer for this film or something to see the way it's animated because it's similar to
Into the
Spider-Verse, yeah, where it's that kind of like 2.5D. It looks very 3D animated. I think it's a frame rate thing
more than anything else.
But it's also the character models and everything like that. But the whole film is hand animated.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's beautiful. It's like it's one of the most beautifully animated films I've ever seen. Mm. And there's a whole subplot as well to this film that Smeerensburg, essentially the reason there's no postal service there is because the town is divided into two families who hate each other.
I forgot all about the Joan Cusack's in that one as well.
Yeah, and so it's this big feud between two families, but then the kids all start hanging out with each other because now they've got all these toys and the parent and the...
That's right, yeah. I watched this a month ago, so...
Yeah, yeah.
And also, in order to write letters to Klaus to ask for toys, they have to learn how to write. And so the teacher who's on the island, yeah, who basically had no students because the kids weren't allowed to learn in the same school as the other kids from the other side of the town.
Yeah.
She was basically using the schoolhouse as like a fishmonger. And she was saving up money to leave because she hated it so much. And then basically because of the sort of selfish actions of the main guy, the postmaster guy, he all the kids want to learn how to read and write. And so then she has to start teaching again. She redevelops her love of teaching and it's just so beautiful. Like I loved the one thing I loved at this movie is that every character does things because of who they are. And there's a natural flow on that comes out of the depth of that character's motivations and it impacts the other characters in a way that actually makes a difference and means something. And it's just so beautiful to see a movie that's so well made with characters that are so well designed and so well written in a way that's going to make sense with each other.
And this is one as well. I don't want to spoil where the film goes, but the film's ending and everything like that and how it ties into like the myth of Santa Claus is beautiful.
It echoes Prince of Egypt for me, like in that level of like this really like stuff that a cartoon that is made to be awe-inspiring and beautiful and not funny.
That word awe is absolutely like appropriate. That's the word that came to mind as well, is that like there are moments in this where you just go like it's I cried. It's so good.
I was getting teary-eyed. I after watching this, I was at work the next day and I was telling people I watched this movie, Klaus, on Netflix. I was like, it's real good. And then I was like talking about it, like, it's actually real good. You need it. You should watch it. And then one of them went home that night to prove me wrong and watched it and then came back to work the next day and was like, yeah, fuck, that's real good.
Yeah.
And so like this is not only like the best Netflix Christmas movie this year, this is one of my favorite films of the year. Mm. And if this won Best Animated Feature, I probably won't even be nominated. If this won Best Animated Feature at the Oscars, I wouldn't be mad.
Yeah, no, totally.
I maintain, this is how I've been describing it to people, is that like if this came out in the 90s and was released by Disney and had Disney behind it, this would be inarguably one of, if not the greatest Christmas films of all time.
In the same way that they pulled in other public domain properties like Tarzan and Cinderella. This is Disney's Santa Claus movie.
Yeah.
You know, but even though it's not Disney,
it just has
Santa
that
Claus.
Same richness, and like it would be looked back on in the same way Aladdin and The Lion King are, and it would be like, because, you know, at the moment it's like, what are the greatest Christmas films of all time? You've got, It's a Wonderful Life, Die Hard, oh, gee, actually, and then Love Actually, which I think its Christmases are numbered.
Yeah. That movie is the opposite of The Christmas Prince.
Yeah. Like Love Actually, within the next 10 years, isn't going to be looked on as fondly.
Are people already criticizing?
Yeah, people are, and it's going to get to the point where that's the majority, I think. Yeah. Or they're like, it's not, they don't play it as much anymore. But, like, please go watch Klaus. Like, we need to make this a Christmas classic.
Oh, this is definitely going to become Christmas canon. Like,
that's the thing, so many films get dumped onto Netflix now that people associate Netflix with...
They'll never say
forgettable,
no.
and I'll never get around to watching it. Like this should be beloved.
Mm, yeah. One thing that I really liked about it as well is that the villains in the film, which are like the heads of these warring factions within the town, their motivation after everyone starts coming together and you know, finding out that there's no reason to hate each other, their motivation is to reignite the feud because that's tradition. And that's it. That's their only motivation. And I was like, how good is that? That's so 2019. That's the real progressive film. And I'm not even using that in like a pejorative, you know, I think it's genuinely like, this is the type of progressive that A Christmas Prince wishes it was, you know, like making their villains be like, no, we have to uphold tradition because that's always been, and versus new characters who are like wanting to buck the trends of traditions, or something I've discovered I'm very passionate about. Mm. So like, it was really awesome to see.
That's genuinely like one of the things I did not like about the movie.
God, what do you mean?
Oh, I just like, just this whole narrative that like everything that's traditional and everything that like has been done. I mean, I completely agree that things that are like horrible that should be continued because they're tradition, that's no reason to continue things. But it was just the narrative that like anything that's traditional is probably going to be dumb and we should just do everything new and pretend
I think the message of the film is more don't be afraid to get rid of those nasty traditions.
To create new ones.
Yeah.
Like, oh, fuck, man. I love this film so
much. When they unveiled the story, like the true story of the woodcutter's life, it was like absolutely devastating. And like, this is one thing that like talking to some parents, like they have actually said that it's a little bit inappropriate for really young kids because their kids got super upset about that sort of stuff. And it's just like, because it is such a beautiful movie and it's cartoon, so I think people think that it's like, oh, this is really fun and it's a cute little fun Christmas movie, and it's actually like it plays around with some pretty huge stuff, man, that scene is so powerful.
Yeah. Hunchback of Notre Dame has a song about how the priest wants to fuck the gypsy, though. So like
and how he wants to fuck them so bad that he wants to kill them.
Yeah, but we're not sitting here advocating everyone goes and watches that.
But finally, Sergio Pablos actually worked on Hunchback of Notre Dame.
But my point being is that the best kids' movies are a little bit inappropriate for kids.
And also, AJ and I have talked a lot on the podcast recently about films being Santatheist or not. And the whole, like, it's essentially the idea whether or not a film actually treats, there's a man who lives at the North Pole who delivers presents or to everyone in the world one night a year. Or if, you know, it's like in real...
Whether Santa's real or not.
Yeah. This film treats that beautifully, I think. Like, yeah. I mean, again,
this is the book of Genesis of Santa.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean...
Or is this film Santagnostic? Is that what you say?
Yeah, I think maybe that's the thing, yeah, that it's Santagnostic.
Yeah, so I just want to bring you guys, because we're talking about how this movie is like the new Christmas classic from Netflix, just want to bring you guys back to last year when you were claiming that Christmas Chronicles was going to be the new Christmas classic from Netflix.
I was so wrong, Jeremy. You were so right.
Oh my god, Jeremy. Oh my god.
Oh man, I can go to bed. I can go to bed tonight happy. Like, that's all I wanted.
No,
thanks,
Christmas
guys.
Chronicles is pretty good. Like, Christmas Chronicles.
Christmas Chronicles was the Let It Snow of last year.
Yeah.
This is an unprecedented margin classes for the Netflix.
Well, it's like, and I'm nothing against these films, but like, Christmas Chronicles is Netflix's Elf, but Klaus is Netflix's It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing wrong with Elf, but it's like, you know, it's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
And also, glad you brought that up, because there is a Christmas Chronicles 2 coming next year. There's recently announced that Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell are definitely going to be back. I think it's next year. It might be 2021, actually. So, but Christopher Columbus is directing that one as well.
Oh, well, he should have directed the first one.
Yeah. Well, he produced the first
That's
one,
That's the missing element from...
Yeah. So, that'll be really interesting. And then, yeah, we are getting Princess Switched again. There's no word on it. I just read a thing that was like, you know, when you ask Google a question or you like type a thing into Google and it comes up with like common questions and then you can like click and reveal the answer. And it's like, is there a Christmas Prince 4? And it's like, there's currently no word on one, but if there is, it'll probably come out in December.
Wow.
Truly the crappy IMDb trivia of future movies.
Yeah.
Well, hey, look, this has been wonderful discussing Christmas movies. I, as unfeasible as I think it is to continue doing this every year, the batch we got this year was much better. Demographics, didn't mention the demographic for Klaus. It's a family movie.
Yes, so, for fucking everyone.
Yeah, yeah, family movie. And everyone so with at the heart. Very least, I can appreciate and respect the fact that this year they gave us a smorgasbord as opposed to the same thing four times, basically. Which isn't exactly what happened last year, but more or less. So any final thoughts? I shouldn't have said that. You're all going to keep talking. We need to wrap this up. It's Christmas.
Yeah. We've got Christmas to have. I don't know.
We've got Christmas. So thank you very much for listening, everybody.
Yeah, congrats on having a baby, Jeremy.
Congrats, Jeremy.
Thanks, guys.
Its name is Jesus. We
don't know who the father is.
We hope you all have a Merry Christmas. We do have one more Christmas episode coming out for the year, which will be our live show.
Yeah.
Which is very exciting.
If you're in Christchurch tonight.
Tonight. Go see it tonight. It comes. We're doing it tonight at Little Andromeda at 7:30. Talking about the Santa Claus trilogy. Anyway, other than that,
Go watch Klaus.
And also, even more important than going to watch Klaus is going and subscribing to Cole Popshaw and all your local social media platforms like Facebook and YouTube and Instagram and Acast, Twitter, that sort of thing.
The common social media platform, Acast.
Yeah, popular. We should have said that. They're not going to listen this far. We have a new YouTube channel for the podcast now. So this episode will actually come out on YouTube on the podcast channel. So go check that out. Please subscribe to it. Looking forward to seeing you guys on the next one. Ho, 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 goodbye. Those words don't melt into each other.
No, they don't.
It's like there's a hard G. There's a hard G there.
Yeah.
Cool.
Bye.
And to all a good night. That's what you say.
Yes.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.